supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
HYY.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We're celebrating the passage of the 25th of the ADA 25 years ago. That's the Americans with Disabilities Act. And a lot has happened in those years. And today we're going to look back at the successes as well as look ahead to what remains a challenge for the millions of us today who live with disability. We're joined today here in the studio with Steve Gold, an ADA lawyer and a friend of mine. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Before we get into the discussion, I want to play a moment with then-President George H.W. Bush at the day of the signing.
Last year, we celebrated a victory of international freedom. Even the strongest person couldn't scale the Berlin Wall to gain the elusive promise of independence that lay just beyond. And so together we rejoiced when that barrier fell. And now I sign legislation which takes a sledgehammer to another wall, one which has for too many generations separated Americans with disabilities from the freedom they could glimpse but not grasp. And once again, we rejoice as this barrier falls, proclaiming together, we will not accept, we will not excuse, we will not tolerate discrimination in America.
Well, that was George Herbert Walker Bush on the day 25 years ago that the Americans with Disability Act, also known as the ADA, was signed into law. I have to say, I cried when I watched that on TV, and I was moved to tears again now. Steve, as we just heard, President Bush signed it into law. But one of the instigators was our own Governor Dick Thornburgh, who was Secretary of State.
And his wife, Ginny.
But his son had their son had multiple disabilities as a result of a car accident. Now, the person who authored the final bill and its chief Senate sponsor in the Senate was Senator Tom Harkin. He introduced the bill in part in sign language, saying that it was so his deaf brother could understand what was happening. So one wonders, well, this one wonders, Steve, would this legislation ever have passed if there weren't personal stakeholders in the process?
Probably not. There's no question that knowing someone really, really well with a disability pushes you to strive and want equality and want to eliminate the discrimination. But every single advocate that I have met has a family member, a cousin, a good friend who is severely disabled. And they know them on a personal level, and they know what they can do, and they know what they need to do, et cetera. But I think that's a great question. It would not have happened.
No. Well, I mean, look at breast cancer. Look at Alzheimer's. Look at so many things. And
correct.
And for the issues that really don't get off the ground, there's still a great deal of shame around it, like severe.
There's still a great deal of shame around disability as well.
Yeah. Sadly, you're right. All right, Steve, are you aware of any opposition to the ADA way back when?
Oh, significant. There were major, major compromises that were made in 1990 when the ADA was passed because of opposition. One, the movie industry. That prohibited open sign language in movies. They won that. Two, the business community. Title III of the ADA is the only civil rights provision that I'm aware of all the civil rights bills we have, where you cannot get monetary damages when you're discriminated against. The only thing that can happen is you can obtain an injunction to stop the discrimination, but no damages. What that does for businesses is an incredible incentive to do nothing. Because if the only thing you're going to lose as a business, and I'm thinking business, you know, a store with two or three steps instead of building a ramp, even after you're asked to several times, and you realize the only thing that could happen is you're not going to lose money because there's no monetary damages for discrimination. The only thing that's going to happen is you're going to have to build a ramp. And you don't build the ramp until you're either sued or threatened with suit, et cetera. It's not a voluntary action.
Let's talk about...
So the business community was very much against it.
So you're touching on what was covered and what was not covered in the legislation. What does it mean to be disabled? And I ask this based on in the legislation. I ask this because years ago I got a call from a woman who said, is there a daycare center that I know of for people with disabilities? And I said, well, not that I know of. And then I thought, well, who would go? I mean, people in wheelchairs would go, and certainly people who were hearing impaired or blind.
Or
cognitive, but then people with autism, and then people with severe mental illness, and then, you know, who'd be minding the store? Everybody would be in the daycare center.
Well, it's an interesting way she phrased the question. See, I would have preferred... let's go back two sentences. The ADA is a civil rights statute, okay? It is not it was never intended to be providing services. It was intended to end discrimination and achieve some level of equality. So the way the woman asked the question to you, Dan, for me, is the wrong way to ask the question. You don't need a separate. I mean, President Bush talked about taking the sledgehammer. She should have said, I have a disabled child. You know, where is a daycare center? And if the daycare center doesn't take the kid, that's discrimination, and that's what you fight.
So who's in and who's out with the ADA? I mean, and we have to say it's not just wheelchairs. It's people with major mental illness.
Wheelchair users, mobility impairments, very small percent, believe it or not, of the people with disability. Yeah. This is both a statutory definition and a federal regulatory definition that talks about significant impairments in daily living activities that impairs your ability to basically function. It's really broad, but it's also, you know, in order to get the benefit of it, the person with disability has to establish that he or she meets that definition. And that's not been the problem in 25 years.
Really?
Yeah, no. I've bought, as you know, lots of lawsuits. It's never been one, well, I'm disabled and I'm not being provided with the services because people don't think I'm disabled. It has, on certain kinds of people, that does affect it. People who have environmental disabilities, for example. Mm-hmm. That is to say, whether I'm thinking, you know, perfume, right, et cetera, right. And they can't go into various hotel rooms because of that, because they get reactions to it. The invisible disabilities, person with mental illness, you know, sitting next to us, you know, looks like and feels like and frequently often sounds like everyone else. But, you know, they can have exacerbations and be very severely disabled.
I want to reintroduce you, Steve. We're talking about the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act with Steve Gold, who is an ADA lawyer. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'd like to hear your story about what's called now universal access for you and or someone you know and love. 888-477-9499. And let's go right to the phones. We've got Richard on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hello. How are you, Dan?
Good, thanks.
I enjoy your program very much.
Thanks. Me too.
Me too.
Well, that's good. The one thing that bothers me about the ADA is I think it has a major flaw in a very short phrase, which says reasonable accommodation. Well, what may be reasonable to me may not be reasonable to you. And a lot of times the only way you can convince somebody is to take them to court.
Steve?
But to me, that is such an easy way out. Well, it's just not reasonable.
Well, I mean, you stated very much the legal term. It is a reasonable accommodation. Think about the following. Think about the Aesop fable, the fox and the stork. Okay? And, you know, the fox could not drink water from from one utensil, and the stork could not drink it from the bowl. So in order to get a reasonable accommodation, you have to sort of figure out on a case-by-case basis how each of them could drink water. And if you put the Americans with Disabilities Act in the context of a civil rights statute, you know, you've got to think about all the time reasonable accommodation. I mean, the simplest way Dan teases me about sometimes about curb cuts and
I was just about to get there. By
okay,
the way.
Well,
take care of Richard.
One of the
first.
Thing, the reasonable accommodation we figure out on a literally case by case basis, and the law and the regulations take into account size of the business, number of employees, total income, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a one size fit all. And there are many times that a disabled person thinks something is doable. When they call me up and they describe it or send me a picture or something else, and I sort of scratch my head and said, boy, that doesn't look reasonable to me. It looks like it's going to be really hard.
But that's, you know, on Richard's behalf here. I mean, it's so vague. So
there's no way to have a specific – there's so many different circumstances that you cannot have a concrete one-size-fit-all.
Richard, do you have a personal story here? Is there something for you or your family?
I'm blind.
Yeah?
And just, you mentioned in curb cuts. Well, curb cuts, I can agree with them. They should be, but they should be off to the side, not in the front. Because when I walk down the street, I have no way to know that the curb is there.
Well, Richard,
I'm sorry, but there is a way. That's for everybody to treat everybody as decent human beings instead of looking out just for me.
Well, it's not looking out just for me. I mean, the Architectural Barrier Board, a federal agency, with oodles and oodles of experts, have tried to figure out ways of doing this. We're now in the third generation of curb cuts. If in Philadelphia area, you now see each of the new curb cuts that are going have these little rubber bubbles, basically. They're for people who are blind, who use a cane. I don't know whether you do or not, Richard, but they're to give you a signal when you're using a cane and coming close to the curb that you are now coming to the curb. So that...
Are you aware, though, that there is a controversy, even in the blind community, about indicating that a curb...
Sure, I am fully aware of that, yes. And the blind community testified before the Architectural Barrier Board, and it's an issue. And so, like a lot of other issues, you know, this is a compromise. But to put it on the side, that part I really disagree with you about, only because if non-disabled people don't have...
Then put yourself a blindfold and try to walk down the street.
I actually have done that. One of my very dearest friends is blind, and we've done that. That doesn't mean doing it once, Richard, gives me any expertise in this, I promise you.
So, what we're hearing is Richard's frustration. And you're going to hear that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things I want to talk, and Richard, thank you so much for your call.
Yes, thank you very much.
And you called the right guy because, you know, you called Steve Gold, who is...
Mr. Curbcut.
Who's Mr. Curbcut. So in 1992, you filed that against the Streets Commission.
My tombstone's going to have a curb cut.
I think your tombstone should actually be... A curb cut.
Okay,
yeah,
probably.
And a path, a wheelchair path up there.
Probably will be.
I'll help you design it. So listen.
You really can blame me, Richard. I was the one who brought that case in 92, and the rest of the country fell in line. Not just the rest of this country. I mean, I get friends who do traveling and say, God, I was in Mexico and I saw one of your curb cuts. One of your curb cuts.
I do have to say, apropos what Richard said, we learn from our mistakes.
Yes.
Hopefully. I mean, you know.
Absolutely correct. And make progress.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the first, when we brought the first curb cut case, Dan, you know, there were no standards.
Right.
Basically, in terms of, there's some slope standards, but we're really now in the third.
Nobody knew.
Well, now we got, we're third generation. I mean, the curb cuts that they're building now are really so much better.
Well, you know, speaking of personal stakeholders, you know, that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I stayed at a hotel several years ago, 10 years ago in L.A., and technically it was, you know, I could get around the hotel, but I had to go around one corner to get a stair lift up and another corner to find the ramp. So I mentioned it to the manager, and he said to me, you know, I really want to make this right for people with disabilities. He said, could I take half hour of your vacation tomorrow and let's go through this. I thought it was great. I said, but before you do, I said, who do you love most in this world? And he said, my daughter. I said, before we meet tomorrow, picture her getting around here in a wheelchair. And by the time we had the meeting, we didn't need a meeting because he knew.
But that, you were able to use empathy to make him relate to your first question to me. Would the law have passed if people didn't know other people?
Right, exactly. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we've got other guests. We've got a young man in Texas who is fairly recently disabled, and we've got a representative from the Christopher Reeve Foundation.
Okay.
On our way out, before we take our break, I want to mention full disclosure here. Speaking of lawsuits, Steve Gold represented me against an airline that broke my wheelchair going one way and then put my wheelchair on another airplane going the other, and that was after the ADA. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Intervention Associates, a subsidiary of Friends Life Care Partners, supports WHYY. A nonprofit, Quaker-based organization, Intervention Associates provides care management and guardianship services for people of all ages. Services include home care, community services, crisis intervention, and patient advocacy. Intervention Associates navigates all available healthcare options and medical benefits. Clients receive a professional needs assessment and detailed care plan. Information at interventionassociates.org.
This is Dr. Ashiwira Ratna from the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. As a Wistar scientist, I'm working hard to help find a cure for melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. My research focuses on how changes in our skin as we age drives the spread of melanoma and makes these tumors resistant to drugs. To find out the importance of wearing sunscreen and more about our science, details are at wistar.org. My name is Ashi, and I am Wistar Science.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. It's the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act, and we're looking back and we are looking forward. We've been talking with Steve Gold, who's an ADA lawyer. Now we're going to be talking we're talking with Kent Stevenson, who is a consumer and works construction from his wheelchair. A little later on, in a few minutes, we're going to hear from Maggie Goldberg. She's a vice president of policy and programs of the Paralysis Research Resources Center for the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, a program I am affiliated with also. So, Ken, let's start with you. By the way, thanks for joining us.
Oh, yeah, it's good. I'm glad to be here.
So you're in Texas. What city?
I am currently in Bullard, Texas. It's just a little south of Tyler, Texas.
Okay. Small city?
Bullard's pretty small.
Okay. So that's relevant in our discussion. So you're 28 years old. You were 3 years old when the legislation was signed. I just have a feeling you weren't watching it on TV.
No, I missed it.
I'm sure you had no interest in it for
not then.
For the first 22 years of your life. And so what happened?
Well, I had a little interest in it because about 5 years before I had an accident. I had a good friend who found himself in a wheelchair. And how I had my accident is I was out I raced motocross professionally, and I had my motor lock up going on the face of a jump, and it caused me to land and crash and break lots of vertebrae in my back and everything. That's how that happened.
So just so we can get a picture of you, I know the vertebrae you broke where your spinal cord was broken was in your thoracic spine, which means your arms work, your hands work.
Yes, sir.
You can use a manual wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
And you can transfer yourself.
Yes, sir.
In and out of your truck. Do you need any nursing care?
Well, luckily I haven't had to have any. Just times that I've acquired accidents in my activities, I've had to have some nursing care here and there. But daily living, no, I don't. I haven't had to require any.
When you say accident, you mean bowel or bladder?
Well, when I first came home, I was running a bulldozer and I dropped a tree. A tree came in and broke my foot and everything.
That's an accident.
And so, yeah, that was an accident.
Yeah.
And then I required some burns from a seat heater that required some help from a nurse.
Yeah, and we should say that you don't have sensation, I would guess, below where you can function. So you wouldn't.
Uh-huh.
It's funny, Kent. I'm a quadriplegic, so when you say accident, I think bowel and bladder. I can't really. You know, I'm a psychologist. I was before my accident, so I could go back. But I can only imagine the devastation for you. I mean, you lost everything you were about, and you had an adrenaline-filled life. Must have been a hell of an adjustment for you.
It was. I mean, it was a big shock right at first, because I went from traveling all over the world, you know, chasing races. I say the world, I mean the United States, chasing, you know, racing events for motocross, to landing myself in a wheelchair and learning the whole bowel and bladder program thing and just how to live from the wheelchair.
Tell us about your life now.
My life now, it's improved drastically because, like, I'm with the Christopher and Dana Reed Foundation, and they sponsor an epidural stimulator program. And I'm actually one of the five that has it. And that thing has, I mean, it's improved my life just drastically. I mean, when I first came home and didn't have it, you know, I had a lot of the bowel and bladder accidents and issues that you have to deal with. But since I've had that, I mean, I'm able to be out here on the job. Like right now, I'm running four different jobs on four different schools here in Bullard. I'm the superintendent over. And having that thing, it's given me the ability to not have any skin breakdowns. And actually, it pretty much eliminated the bowel and bladder issues that you run into.
I just want to repeat that word, epidural stimulation. And, you know, if any listeners want to find out more about it, it's online. You can certainly find out about it from the Christopher and Dana Reeve.
Yeah, you can go to, actually, they have a whole website dedicated. It's reevebigidea.org.
All right.
And you can find a little backdrop on me and all the other guys.
So you're running around, you're doing all this work, or you... how are you doing emotionally?
Pretty good. The other day, I actually had a little emotional breakdown because I was having to deal with some faulty GPS equipment, and I had all my guys looking at me, and that was kind of where being in the wheelchair was setting in a little, because I wasn't able to. I had all these guys looking at me and depending on me, and at the time, I wasn't able to tell them how to do the job, because what I relied on, my GPS equipment that gives me my grades and everything, dumped out on me. But other than that, I mean, emotionally, I'm pretty good.
I have the same problem with GPS. It has nothing to do with being disabled.
It's about maturity for many of us. So, Kent, when you look at your life now, tell us about the ADA and what you have to thank.
I mean, I am very, you know, thankful for that going in effect, because, I mean, because of that, I'm able to stay away from my home at these hotels around here because they have to be ADA compliant. They have roll-in showers and, you know, cut-out sinks and taller toilets. And then even on the job site, that same act has helped me because they have handicapped accessible porta-potties.
That's great. So I want to turn to Maggie Goldberg now, who's from the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, Ken just gave you that great plug.
He sure did.
So you got that going for you. So what would life have been like for Kent before the ADA?
Well, I think he would not have as much access to buildings, number one. I don't think, you know, he lives in rural Texas, so I don't know how much he would use public transportation. And although public transportation remains a consistent concern, if he were to live in a major city, I think he would be able to access buses, and in New York City in particular, taxis.
Steve, you want to go on?
His job, I think employment would not be secure. I think, you know, just it would be a completely different world.
How much do you think the ADA has changed our culture?
Maggie?
I'm sorry, that was for me?
Yeah.
I think the ADA has changed our culture tremendously in the sense that I think disability, living with disability, is really a civil rights issue. And it's hard to address if you don't know anyone, to your point when you started the show. If you don't know anyone living with disability, why are you going to care about it? And it's only when you see we want everyone living with disabilities to be interactive, participatory citizens of our society. And I think that's what ADA ultimately strives to do.
How many people with disabilities, Maggie, do you think recognize the ADA as a civil rights statute?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer. I hope most of them do.
Well, I want to address that first question about how it's changed the culture. I'll tell you this. You know what's changed? The way people look at me has changed over these last 20 years.
Less stigma?
I'm not even going to use that word because
okay,
I don't
good.
Know. It's the way people look at me. I feel part of the culture now, and I did not 25 years ago. And I'm not going to tell you when or how the transition took place, but I'm part of this culture now, and I wasn't 25, 30 years ago.
And the analogy with the LGBT is very strong.
Right. Yeah, it's the same thing. Ken, tell us how you trained for the job.
How I trained for the job?
Yeah.
Well, I start out, I estimate the job out, and I pull it up, and I do the takeoff on it to see, you know, how much cut and fill I have and if I'm going to need to import dirt or export dirt and everything. And then if there's demo in it, I price out my demo, and that's how I come up with my price to bid this job.
Ken, Maggie mentioned public transportation. I know that's,
oh, yeah.
That's a big deal for so many people, including all of us who are having this conversation. What's public transportation like for you?
During my 5 years I lived in Louisville, that was something that was eye-opening for me in Louisville, is that the public transportation is all accessible. I was able to get on, there's certain trolleys that were marked, and I could get on those trolleys and be able to go around town with the people I was hanging out with there. So that was something that was eye-opening for me, coming from a small area, like y'all said before. You can go ahead.
So, Steve, I want to turn to you. How are we doing in Philly? I mean, that was another one of your lawsuits.
Yeah, a number of lawsuits. you take on buses, the subways, et cetera, regional rail, et cetera. We're making progress. I mean, it's incredibly slow. Right now, about 2-3 years ago, we hit 100% of buses are now fully accessible. They're not designed as well as you want. This is an old city, so they're not as wide as you want. So people, you know, it's not easy, but they're accessible. We're making some progress with regards to the rapid transit. When I brought a lawsuit in the mid-'80s, I was asked, why do you want an elevator down to the subway? There's no other place to get off. And I said, well, over time there will be. And in fact, we have a large number of stations now that are accessible. Not all of them. And it'll be another 20, 25 years, in my opinion, before every station is accessible. But we're making progress. And you see people, Dan, now on buses and on the subway and the other who are disabled, you know, who are using them, which is terrific.
I want to switch gears here for a little bit, and I want to go to our callers. We've got Laura on the line. Hi, Laura. Laura?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling in regard to people with developmental disabilities. I have a daughter who recently was removed from an intermediate care facility and placed in a group home in New Jersey due to a program called Return Home New Jersey. And what I've discovered is that many of the direct care staff are not trained or educated well enough to be caring for an individual like my daughter. She's profoundly disabled. I'm happy to see her out of an institutional-type setting, but unfortunately, the home that she's been placed in is lacking on so many levels.
How old is she?
She will be 27 this week.
Well, one of the good things about the provider network for people with disabilities who have cognitive is that it's a big network. Get her in a different program. This is very competitive now. The private providers that provide home-based services are very competitive. Get her in a program that meets her needs.
But we're in the process of looking at other agencies, but I come across the same thing, where you have very poorly paid staff, and the majority of them are women who have to hold down more than one job. So a lot of times they work 16, 18 20-hour days.
That really is a problem.
Because absolutely.
It's pay, it's benefits.
Well, it's the money part with this is a major problem that has been a fight. It has actually increased in intensity in the last year or two. They are poorly paid, and it's inexcusable. I mean, the job they do is really important. If we really believe what President Bush said about integration, about mainstream, et cetera, it has to be with quality, and it has to be with dignity, and it has to be with all the benefits and safety and security so that you as the mother feel good about it.
Let me I want to take that into a different direction. And Kelly, I'm going to thank you for your call here, but I do want you to listen to this next question, and that is this, and this is directed to you too, Maggie, and maybe to you, Kent. Where are the young lawyers today? Where are the young activists who are going to get up and going to raise hell and make people feel uncomfortable? Are they out there?
A little bit. Not as much as you or I would want, Dan. I am now 73, and you and I have had this discussion about retirement, my retirement, not yours. I don't think you'll ever have to. But there are a few, not as many as we want, and it scares me a lot because the ADA is not a self-executing a statute. That is to say, one of the first telephone persons who called, yeah, you have to sometimes sue, and sometimes you have to sue a lot. And unless there are lawyers out there ready to do that, interested in doing it, and competent to do it, one of my real fears is that at the 50th anniversary, we're going to say this is a moribund statute that, you know, has never really been implemented.
Of course, that's my fear also. Maggie, I want to hear from you, because you have access to many tens of thousands, if not more, people with disabilities. Where's the fight in there?
You know, that's a great question. I think that the fight is there. I think people are advocating, but it's hard to fight and gather momentum around something unless it's a severe injustice. And perhaps people are used to the ADA, and that's why the fighters are not as strong. I think also people are fighting insurance companies these days. They're fighting for jobs.
Managed care companies.
Exactly. So, when you think about how hard it is to live, that's where the energy is going.
Yeah, but all those are potential lawsuits. Everything, Maggie, you said, a lawyer who wants to take them on – to implement the ADA.
Yeah, where are the lawyers speaking about low-paying jobs?
Well, we have every state has an entity called the Disability Rights Network, and they're really great lawyers. Philadelphia has one of the best.
Repeat it.
Disability Rights Network. Every state has it. It's federally
we're
funded.
We're familiar with them as well. They're terrific.
They are terrific.
All right. So we'll get that on our webpage.
Okay, thank you.
And you'll get us the information,
easily.
Steve or Maggie. I do want to say here in Philadelphia that if you have experienced discrimination, please contact the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations. That's what they do. That's their job. And they'll raise hell on your behalf.
And the president of that is blind.
There you go. Talk about stakeholders.
Right.
So we've got
and a lawyer.
We've got to take a short break here. I hope Maggie Kent. I hope you can stay on the line with us.
Certainly.
Okay.
Okie doke. So we've been talking with Steve Gold, who's an ADA lawyer. Maggie Goldberg is vice president of policy and programs with the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. Ken Stevenson is a 28-year-old young man who is a paraplegic and he works construction. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's CARON.org.
Devereaux supports WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has worked to provide loving and clinical care to some of the most vulnerable members of society, including individuals on the autism spectrum. Austin, who first attended a Devereaux school at age 5, was almost entirely unable to communicate. Through a combination of his mother's advocacy, his hard work, and the support of Devereaux, he said, "I love you," to his mother for the first time. More about Devereaux's programs and services online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are, celebrating, reviewing the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Trying to figure out, Dan, whether the glass is half full or half empty.
And exactly. And our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I do want to talk about what needs to be done here. We're far from having an accessible country. Steve, we'll start in Philadelphia. Taxi cabs.
Well, unfortunately, the way the law was passed at the beginning of the show, you asked for compromises that are things that were lacking in the ADA. When the Congress passed it, another strong industry that got its way was the taxi industry. So that if an individual taxi is not sitting six people or more, it doesn't have to be accessible under the law. So you got a law that stinks, unless the city, as in New York now is going to have only accessible taxis, or in Philadelphia where we sued the Philadelphia Parking Authority, and we're going to have 150, 200 taxis in X number of years that will be accessible. Equality? No, but better than we got now.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I got to tell you, I was recently in Barcelona, and they've got accessible taxis.
How about London? All those black taxi cabs are all accessible.
There's a restaurant I wanted to get to, so the hotel guy at the hotel says, "Well, I'll call you a taxi." A taxi came and took me to the damn restaurant. And I was so happy. All I wanted to do was take cabs for the rest of my vacation in Barcelona.
We may, unfortunately, there are lots and lots of shortfalls in the ADA. That's one.
Yeah, you're not kidding. Let's go back to the phones. We've got George on the line. Do we have him? George?
Nope.
No. Yeah, George? No, we're having a problem with that. Maggie, I wanted to ask you a quick question.
Sure.
The ADA is about accommodation, and it's not about basic research. And I know the foundation is really about both. Do you think the ADA has helped indirectly advance research?
That's I don't know.
I'll
left for an answer. ADA helped advance research. That's true. You know, I
certainly believe you could make the case. I mean, it goes back to your point of you didn't want to use the word stigma, but you know, you think about when Christopher Reeve was injured, he put a public face on spinal cord injury and what that meant. And because of that, here at the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, our donations quadrupled, and we were able to fund that much more money into research. Did the ADA help? I don't know. I think the more we make the public aware of life with disabilities, it has an impact. I mean, you look at the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge last summer. You know, that was a marketing campaign that ultimately affected research. Did it affect the day-to-day lives of people with ALS? It will in the long run when that, you know, the research discoveries.
Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't want to put a value judgment, but obviously I just did. So much more money goes into research than goes into funding advocacy. I mean, if the ADA is going to really be a meaningful law in 5, 10, 15 years, we're going to have to confront, the disabled community is going to have to confront really taking on institutions as advocates do it. The same way the LGBT did it, state by state, and they were very successful, right, in terms of organizing. The other thing that the disability community has to deal with, really critical, they got to get rid of the whole mentality of charity and pity and really focus on disability and equality and dignity. And unfortunately, there aren't that many advocates out there. I mean, most of the people, you know, need and want jobs, totally reasonable. And only the research places like your own basically have that money for that, not the fun advocates or organizers.
Let's we've got George on the line now. Hey, George.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Okay. What can we do for you?
I'm just listening to your program this morning, and I asked for comments about how we see things, how life's more accessible over the last 20-some years. My wife's in a wheelchair. She's been paralyzed since she was 16 years old in 1983. So we've seen a lot of changes in how we get around. There's still a lot needed, you know, help. There's a lot of things that are helpful. But another comment you made there about being in Europe, I was in Barcelona and Paris and Rome and London last year, and London being the most accessible city, more than a lot of cities here in town, here in this country. But although the Disabilities Act has made quite a big difference in a lot of things like that, and again, like the gentleman or the lawyer said, there's a lot of things, advocacy stuff still needed to be done, you know? But no, a big difference.
Yeah, there sure have been.
Dan, I mean, we always focus on advocacy in terms of curb cuts, et cetera, et cetera. But one area that has been a peeve of mine and a focus of mine for many years, we have right now in the United States 1.4 million disabled people who are unnecessarily institutionalized in nursing homes. Every single person in a nursing home has a mirror image living in the community with appropriate services. I mean, the same way that quadriplegics need assistance with activities of daily living, so do every single person in the nursing home. They could all be integrated in the community if we had adequate housing, which is a major, major concern about accessibility, and also people really giving the choice of whether to live in the community with services or to live, it's their choice, in the institution. But you're talking about 1.4 million.
Yeah, that's a big number. George, thanks so much for your call. And it does help give us perspective.
Sure.
You know, I talked about in an essay I wrote. I think it's going to be published on our webpage. It was on the Huffington Post about how, you know, right after my accident, which was in the very end of 1979, I used to like hockey back then. So I'd go into the old Spectrum and I'd have to sit behind the last right. row with my under an overhang where my chin was down in my chest. And of course, when something happened exciting,
forget
all
it.
I saw was a lot of people's butts. And
well, we've
believe me,
that.
That's no but that's pain and suffering.
We've remedied that in Philadelphia with the stadium.
It's been that, and that's my point.
And
it's,
the baseball stadium.
It's been
I know you're a baseball fan.
I know. I am. Let's leave that.
But at least you can see a team.
So let's talk about what can be done. And Ken, I want to start with you. We still have you there?
Yes.
All right. So you're a young guy, and things seem to be going pretty well for you. What would you want to see in the future for people with a whole variety of disabilities?
There's a lot of things. I mean, the parking, getting the parking situated for, like, designated for people strictly with wheelchairs.
Yeah.
That would be, because I've had confrontations the past couple weeks with people who get mad because all the handicap spots are taken up, so I have to take up two regular spots
right.
so I can get my wheelchair and everything out. And you wouldn't believe the people who just want to get mad at you about that. And then they see your wheelchair. I had one guy come in a restaurant, and in the middle of a group of people I was eating with, and like say something about it. And then he saw I was in a wheelchair, and he just kind of went about his own business after that. But I mean, that's something. Continuing to make all the buildings accessible, like elevators, and it's something that would be if they like, you know how you have go kart tracks.
Yeah.
And there's one in Louisville that actually adapted a cart with hand controls and made it to where paras or quadriplegics could drive it, like they have different adapters. So that's something that Texas, I haven't found yet around here in Texas. You know, but I know, I guess that would be kind of something if they just would push more for these recreational places out here to accommodate for more of us.
How about 70% unemployment among people with disabilities?
That's a big one.
I mean, you're lucky. You got a job, and it sounds like a great job. But unemployment,
yeah.
We've made almost no progress right. in 25 years.
Right. I want to go back to the phones because there's a friend of mine that I asked to call in. Arthur, do we have – you have you on the phone, Art? Art?
Yes.
There you are. So I introduced you as a friend of mine. Could you – You're also in a wheelchair. Tell us about the playground, please. Jake's place.
Art, and I am an adult who has a disability. I was born with spina bifida. I am a wheelchair user, and I do also use crutches for walking short distances. And recently, the last 2.5 years or so, I've been involved with a nonprofit organization called Build Jake's Place. We build accessible playgrounds. And I think this is something very important, something that is missing from the ADA, where children need that interaction, and not just for children, but also for adults who have disabilities like myself. We now, because of Jake's Place, we have children,
and
a safe playground.
And we should also mention the Miracle League, which is a
yes.
fully accessible
yes.
field for people with all sorts of disabilities that play in that league.
Yeah, yes, our Camden County, New Jersey Miracle League is a baseball league. It's a program run by Build Jake's Place and funded by the Camden County Freeholders, where we really just help everyone play. Open from ages 5 and above. We have a 5-year-old, and we have a 60-year-old as one of our players. We have over 60 registered players that we help participate in baseball.
It's really great and very exciting. How do people find you, Art?
They can find us on our website, buildjakesplace.org.
There you go.
And they can contact me. My email address is art at buildjakesplace.org.
All right. That's great. Thanks so much for your call. Art, thanks. Thanks so much for the work you do. I really appreciate that.
Dan, can I put a plug? This Saturday at the National Constitutional Center at 10:30 is a massive celebration of the ADA. And we'd like all your listeners in the region to come and join us.
I would also say that there's a disability parade that leaves City Hall at 1 p.m., goes down Market Street to the National Constitution Center, where the celebration continues. You took care of...
Thank you very much.
You took care of my clothes.
Okay.
I want to thank you for that input. Maggie, quickly, just tell me, what do you see going forward?
Well, I'd like to see, in addition to the really important, the importance of having employment addressed, because that is a huge problem, I want to reassess how healthcare facilities are constructed when we think about the ADA and what we need to see. Think about, you know, all the access to buildings, but what about doctor's offices or dentist's offices? We know that women with disabilities who receive mammograms is 61% compared to 74% for women without disabilities. So I'd like our healthcare system to acknowledge that as well.
Yeah, most of my doctors I can't get on the examining table, and it took me a lot of work to find a dentist's office where A, he would take care of my teeth while I was in the wheelchair, and B, where there's room to get into.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And then just the day-to-day, getting into a restaurant. If you use a wheelchair, why do you have to go through the kitchen rather than the main entrance? Accessible bathrooms, both in public places as well as workplace. Things like that.
Yeah,
Day-to-day life.
I've seen my fair share of freight elevators. And,
I'm sure you have.
Yeah, I don't recommend them, by the way, especially before a meal. It really screws up dinner. Steve, Maggie, Kent, I want to thank all three of you for joining us, and especially for you advocates. On a personal note, I am deeply, deeply grateful for the work you do. We've been acknowledging, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act with Steve Gold, Maggie Goldberg, and Kent Stevenson. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. You can follow us. We're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam. You can email us at voices@whyy.org. You can find me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Leah Kaufman is our intern. Larry Roebling produces the show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Take care of yourselves, please.